Okay.
Now, I had described the two different types of flights we did on the recce flight. One was called the air romp, where we flew around mainly the Arctic islands or the high Arctic mainland, listening to pick up signals or anything that was going on, and with the secondary mission of reporting wildlife, mainly herds of muskox, caribou, polar bear, what have you. The other one, the more interesting job, was the Apex rocket, which was flights sent up to find and take photos of the Soviet ice islands. Now, in the late 1940s, the Canadian government set up various stations which were called weather stations across Canada. One, for instance, was in Eklavik on the Mackenzie Delta. Another one was in Fort Chimo on the tip of the Quebec, northern Quebec, at Ungava Bay up there. There was one at White Horse, one at Alert Bay on the north end of Ellesmere Island, etc. In fact, I think there was one in Churchill. But anyway, these weather stations also had a radio listening station, and they intercepted the Soviet radio signals from their drift ice islands and were able to take bearings from them. So with these bearings, they were pretty well able to roughly track the flow of these ice islands. Now, these stations were either an ice island or a large piece of drift ice. They were large enough to land aircraft on and things like that. I mean, in other words, they'd be at least a mile in diameter. These islands drifted sort of in a circular motion and around the pole area, and with that, the Soviets, over a period of about 10 or 15 years, were probably able to accurately map the ocean floor of the Arctic basin. Now, it took the Western powers a long time to figure out just what they were up to, but I think it was obvious that what they were doing was sounding the ocean floor, getting an accurate map of the ocean floor with the thought of having nuclear submarines in the future. I think that's what it was all about.
Right.
So anyway, as I said, we had our listening stations who kept sort of tracking them, whenever there was a little more activity, we'd start wondering what was going on. So in the summer months, we were able to launch one of these Apex rockets. Now, the first successful one was flown by 408 Squadron in 1954. The pilot was Pablo McKenzie, who later became a general. And the navigator was Mo Gates, who actually has written a story on 408 Squadron. He became a full colonel in his career. So anyway, they were the first to locate one of these ice islands. In the April of 1957, when I was on one of my last flights on 408 Squadron, they sent us off on an Apex rocket. We flew up to Thule, then took off the next morning, flying over Alert Bay and then heading up towards the pole. I'll check my logbook, because that flight was something like 12 hours and some minutes long. In other words, most of that was either going up or coming back. So I think I have a comment on exactly where it was. Okay, that flight was 12 hours and 25 minutes. We took off from Thule, flying north for about 5 hours or so, which with the Lancaster flying at 180 knots, it was the average ground speed. That 5 hours, or 5 or 6 hours, or 5.5 hours perhaps of flying, would have taken us well over 1,000 miles flying up over the Arctic. So I think we were well over the pole, probably over on the Soviet side. Now, the map with all of the station locations which Sean Mahoney has on in his article had that was drift station number 7, had it just southeast of the pole in the Canadian sector. But I think with that amount of flying we did, that it was probably further up. However, when we got up into close to the area where the station was supposed to be, we picked up a radio signal, and you know, this was unusual up there. I mean, it was usually quiet as a mouse. So we homed in on it, and there we found drift station number 7. And the reason we picked up this radio signal, it was a beacon, because they were being resupplied by a Soviet version of the DC-3 aircraft. This was a rather strange looking thing, because they had removed the landing gear and put fixed skis on it. So anyway, just around the time that we arrived on top and there saw the ice on below us, we saw this aircraft landing there. So anyway, we went about doing what we're supposed to do, doing photo runs, taking pictures, continuing pictures off the whole operation. We probably remained on station for about 30 minutes, and then, of course, we wanted to get off back home as soon as we could, because we'd probably already used up half of our gas load. And one of the problems in flying, especially in Thule, was that the weather could turn bad very quickly, because they could have strong winds and snowstorms and what have you. The visibility could be down to zero. And we were, of course, we're on radio silence, so we wanted to get back home as soon as we could, which we did. We got back into Thule, Greenland, and sent a signal back to Otto saying that we had found the station and had good photo coverage. So the following day we flew back to Rockcliffe. We're met in a debriefing by the director of air intelligence, who was a full air commodore or brigadier general. They were very keen to talk to us, and we got quite a well done for the job we had done. But that was one of my interesting flights. I had one more flight before leaving the squadron. I think it was a day or two later, I went up on an air test with Squadron Leader Brown. He loved flying Lancasters because he had trained so hard flying them as a dam buster. So he liked to get up and put a Lancaster through his paces. A lot of people were afraid to fly with him, but he wanted to have take me along for one last flight with him. I was quite impressed with the guy. A lot of people didn't like him because he was a very hard driver, but if you were on his side, you're all right. Yeah. So anyway, that was the end of my period with 408 Squadron. I turned in all my my winter flying suit and parka and mukluks. And from then on, for the next 3 years, I flew with my best dressed blue uniform flying VIPs. So that's probably the coverage of my experiences. Perhaps there's a few other things I could fill in if you have any other questions.
Well, there's a few. I mean, what I'm fascinated by your. I believe we discussed earlier there was a Time magazine article.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I have it here. I'll give you a copy of that.
So, if you could maybe go over the backstory on that, I know we discussed it earlier.
Yeah. Actually, the other another one upstairs, but no, there it is. The spies, yeah, the spies that came out of the cold. That's it. Now, that was again written by Sean Mahoney.
Oh, okay.
Now, another, he mentions the, as I said, the heading here, radioactive debris from Soviet atmosphere nuclear tests. During that period in the mid to mid-50s to I guess to the mid-60s, the Soviets were started off testing atomic bombs and then hydrogen bombs, and of course the Western powers were very interested in how things were going, how they were being developed, etc. And we could do that by tracing their radioactive fallout. Now, the Defense Research Board under Dr. Salant had developed devices for collecting the radiation. We called them bug catchers. They were installed on the outer fuselage of the aircraft. And we would have flights starting in somewhere in northern Canada and fly down as far as probably Florida or even the Caribbean. At we'd fly along at and the one flights I was on would be about 20,000 feet, flying straight down, collecting this the debris from a nuclear test. Now, at that time, you had no problem flying at 20,000 feet because all of the airliners were non-pressurized, the old DC-6s, etc. They only flew at, you know, seven up to 7 or maybe 8,000 maximum. So at that time, anything above, we'll say, 10 or 12,000 feet was strictly for the military had that, and so we could easily fly a direct flight, we'll say, from northern Canada down to as far as Florida, collecting this debris. Apparently, the equipment which developed by Defense Research was far more accurate than what the Americans had come up with. So we were sharing this information with them, which they readily accepted, and of course claimed that it was their own. But as apparently the Defense Research Board had a little test one time to see whether they really were using it, was by holding it back a bit and finding that the Americans were clamoring for more. Now, we were doing that on both coasts. 408 did it on the East Coast, and 407, a maritime squadron in Comox, BC, was doing it on the West Coast. In fact, they were flying from the Aleutians all the way down to California, I guess, flying the same type of mission around 20,000 feet or so, just flying straight down and collecting all this information. So that gave the scientists a pretty good idea of how the Soviets were developing or progressing with their atom bomb and H bomb development. In fact, apparently their H bombs were rather dirty, and we were extremely lucky that they were never used, because I think the fallout would have been horrendous.
Really?
Yeah.
How often did you fly those flights? And maybe when would you have started flying these?
Whenever there was a test.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. After the test, we'd be called out to fly a series of missions just to collect as much of the radioactive information as we could.
Wow.
So every time, and the tests were especially when they were developing their H bomb, they were one after another. You know, they were normally testing up in the very high Arctic islands called and you must forgive my pronunciation of an island called Nova Zemlya or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. That was the area where they normally did their testing. And of course the fallout was pretty heavy, of course, across the Canadian Arctic, which probably is still there.
Yeah.
One of the unfortunate consequences of the Cold War.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. If I can just sort of ask, either on those flights or on the flights when you were doing the survey work, did you ever have either, were you accompanied by National Research Council personnel, any other federal departments, or was it strictly Royal Canadian Air Force?
Okay. One, in the summer of 1955, an interesting flight I failed to mention was, flying in a Dakota, we were sent to take a group of cameramen from the National Film Board and also CBC. We took them, flew up to Fort Simpson and then into the Nahanni Valley, along the Nahanni Valley, Nahanni River. And we flew the entire length of that valley. The cameramen, we let them take the side windows out of the DC-3 to get their cameras out, and more or less held on to them by their heels so they wouldn't fall out. Then flying along, and they were just shouting and remarking about how spectacular it was. It was a beautiful day, clear as a bell, and the scenery was fantastic. I've never seen anything like it. It is a beautiful country where probably some of the first people to really see it by air for its entire length. I'm sure that various people had flown over it back and forth over the years, but we flew the entire length and it was a remarkable flight. Some of the statements they were making, saying, you know, this is even beats the Grand Canyon. Well, I'm not sure it didn't in size, but it probably in its being spectacular, it was at least as equal to it. But that is quite the country. Yeah, that was a remarkable flight. Now, for some of our other flights, our air romps, for instance, we'd occasionally take someone from the other government departments because one of our sidelines was every now and then we'd do an ice recce. I recall doing one in Lancaster Sound one time, one summer. In fact, that summer, Canada had just launched its first icebreaker, and the Department of Transport crews didn't really have the expertise yet to take it up in the Arctic. So for the first year that ship was in operation, the Navy ran it. And I recall we did an ice recce on Lancaster Sound for the Labrador, which was proceeding up there. This was in probably late August, I guess. It was a real snowstorm flying along there. Mind you, we could see enough to do our job, but then we called the Labrador, talked to them on the radio. We said, were heading back home, or we'd be landing in Rockcliffe, and they said, they remarked that they'd be up there for another month or so. So anyway, one thing about coming back from the Arctic in the summer, as soon as you descended to about 3,000 feet, we'll say, over Ottawa, you could smell the greenery, the smell of the greenery really hit you, because up in the Arctic, of course, there wasn't anything green at that time of year, and that was something that did impress me. You feel your back coming back to summer because you could even smell it. Another thing, flying south in the summer months, was landing and seeing darkness, because if you hadn't seen darkness for a few weeks, this seemed unusual.
Wow. What, 408 Squadron had transitioned from, you were discussing the reconnaissance phase, I think the Shoreline survey ended in 57, is that right? Or
57,
they
finished. Yeah, 57, they finished the mapping of the Arctic. The geodetic people took all that information with all the measurements from the various Shoreline transits, and then immediately started working on maps, which they came up with accurate maps of all of the Northwest Territories.
So,
yeah, from 57 through to about 63 or so, 408 was strictly a reconnaissance squadron flying in the Arctic, doing the air romps and the Apex rockets. Finally, in about 63, the engines had pretty well worn out, and there was no more parts for them, etc. Actually, during the Shoreline operations, with all of the taking the wet and dry bulb temperatures right from the surface level up to the maybe 10 or 20,000 feet, all that climbing and descending was pretty hard on those engines. And even when the last year I was on Shoreline Ops in 1956, we flying from Cambridge Bay to Churchill one night, shortly after we'd taken off, one of the engines started overheating, so we shut it down, no problem. We still had three, and we could fly along without any problem with three. However, not long afterwards, in fairly quick succession, two more engines shut down. They failed completely, so at that point we're down to one engine, which the old Lancaster could not maintain altitude, and one engine you're steadily descending. And at that point, that was the first time I'd ever worn a parachute really in all my flying, but we put on our parachutes. We're thinking, good God, we'll have to bail out, and it's minus 40 outside and all that. However, actually, I'd sent out a Mayday message too, and everyone was listening to us, and we were sending one position after another every 30 minutes or so. We'd give a complete position report. Then finally, you know, we were steadily going down, and so the pilots said, you know, maybe we should try that first engine we shut down. And by that time, of course, it had cooled off completely. So they restarted it. It seemed to be running fine. So they set it at a little less than full power, and that was enough to give us the increased lift, and it got us down to Churchill. But we had some anxious moments on that flight.
What was it like?
We could have bailed out over a place called Baker Lake, which is just about halfway down between Cambridge Bay and Churchill. Wow. Wouldn't have been much fun.
No. No.
So anyway, that was an indication that those engines were wearing out, because they've been flying steadily for 10 years.
Right.
Yeah. And they were, the Lancaster didn't have the Rolls-Royce Merlin. It was the Packard Merlin built in the United States, which wasn't quite as good as the Rolls-Royce Merlin, which was installed in the North Star.
Right.
They kept chugging on for a long time. Oh. Actually, I guess the North Stars went into service about the same time as the last Lancaster did, too. They replaced them with the turboprop aircraft, the Yukon was called.
That's right. Yeah. What was it like operating as air crew in the Lancaster in the North? What was the what were the conditions like? What did you face?
Noisy as can be.
Yeah.
To talk to someone, you'd almost have to lean over and talk in their ear. Of course, we had the intercom, it wasn't too cold when you got flying. We had a heating system which warmed it up, but my God, when it was minus 40 below in Resolute Bay, sitting out there when they're starting the engines and before they got warmed up, it was mighty cold.
Yeah.
Just sitting there, you know, waiting. Yeah. And we had woolen gloves without any fingers, you know, because the navigator would have to use his fingers to do his plotting, and I'd have to use my fingers for keying the Morse code, which was the communications at that time.
What about for ground crew? Do you remember the ground crew in the North and what they faced servicing the aircraft?
They deserved an awful lot of credit. Boy, I recall lying in bed in Resolute Bay and hearing the engines start up at about 6 o'clock in the morning. They had what was called a Herman Nelson heater, which was a diesel oil filled heater, which with big fans and long tubes, which they blew air around the cowlings of the engines and got them warmed up to a certain degree. The old Merlin engine was pretty good at starting in cold weather too. It was a fairly versatile aircraft, but if one wouldn't start, you'd get the Herman Nelsons on it for the half an hour and that would warm it up. But you would get one, if you got one Lancaster engine, one Merlin engine going, then you'd have enough generators going to really give you the power to get the others going. So, but it was cold. We dressed warmly. We had winter flying suits and a big parka, and we had mukluks on our feet. These were excellent footwear. It was a huge, very thick felt sock type of thing with nylon, waterproof nylon boot on it with a rubber sole. But they kept your feet warm. They were good.
Wow. So obviously your work with 408 later during the reconnaissance phase brought you into contact with the Soviet Union, the Cold War, more than many of the other flights. But I'm just trying to get an idea, what impact did your squadron feel you had on the Cold War, or the Cold War had on your squadron at the time?
Well, it was actually, other than the mapping, the recce flight, that was our reason to be.
Right.
Yeah. We were aware of what was going on. The rest of the squadron really didn't know anything about the recce flight. You had to be a member of the flight before you knew what was going on. Would you just excuse me
absolutely.
For a minute?
Absolutely.
These operations. Did they want the local people to know what was going on? I don't know. But Sean Mahoney covers that quite well in this article, in the journal. He gets into the political side of it, the political thinking. It was quite interesting, a few comments he made. One about this Norman Robertson, who was the head of, I suppose, of the external affairs. If you Google him, research him, the CIA had fingered him as a communist, as a communist mole. He eventually committed suicide. He jumped out of a window when he was in the embassy in Cairo later on, because he felt they were closing in on him. Wow. Now, he also was a friend of Lester Pearson, so things were rather touchy.
Yeah, I can believe that. What about the mapping operation? Did you feel, and I'll let you obviously take your time, but did the mapping operation in the Shoran side of things have that same contribution to the Cold War, or what was the general sentiment of the purpose of that?
Definitely. Not only the Cold War, I think the mapping operation did more to enhance Canada's sovereignty of the Arctic than anything we had done for a long time.
Right.
It really did. The problem was, and I think the Canadian government realized it, was that the Americans were gradually moving in and thinking, you know, this is ours. We had to do something. We had to establish our sovereignty. One thing that happened was they moved a bunch of Inuit from northern Quebec up to Resolute Bay. Because it started because I think the Canadian government thought that if we had some civilian presence in that area, that would enhance our claim for the sovereignty. Now, at that time, none of the Inuit lived that far north. They were mainly along the mainland and some of the southern Arctic islands. None had ever lived as far north as Resolute. So the government found that there was a colony, or we'll say a group of Inuit who are not doing too well. They're in fact quite destitute and tend to be starving half the time, living around the Ungava Bay in northern Quebec. They decided they'd move them up to Resolute Bay. They were under the care of an RCMP constable who was a great guy. He became so attached to them that he used to go out with them with their dog teams, and they'd go out across the ice. He even crossed the ice all the way to Thule, Greenland, because apparently he liked having the occasional bottle of rum. Because I know when we were flying in that area, he was always around. In fact, he'd clear customs for us when we came back from Thule. But he'd say, if you're going to Thule, would you bring me back a bottle of rum? So we'd bring him back a bottle of rum, and we'd have many bottles of our own, which he'd just wave us through. Finally decided that we couldn't clear customs with him in Resolute Bay anymore, that we had to do it when we finally came back to Rockcliffe. But anyway, that was an aside. But yeah, that was one of the ways that the means that they had of establishing their sovereignty, because I think it might have been a bit touch and go at that time. You know, the Americans, as you know, reading the history, they were always ready to acquire more territory, and they would have gladly taken over the whole Canadian Arctic.
Yeah.
Which now I think finally the Canadian Arctic is going to start paying for itself.
Yeah.
Probably in the future it'll be paying for itself in a big way.
So what about the squadron within the RCAF? What do you feel the perception was within the squadron of the RCAF's view of what 408 was doing.
They considered us just, we'll say, a bunch of sprogs and has-beens. Yeah. In other words, most of us were young people. We didn't have the glamour that the jet people, the F-86 pilots or what have you, had. You know, we were, I guess, the workhorses were considered maybe a bit that way by the rest of the Air Force. The rest of the Air Force didn't have a clue about the Apex rocket flights. They knew that we're doing this big job of mapping the Arctic, and they knew that we spent every summer in the Arctic. But I know, as George probably said when he got flying on North Stars, that they thought that all we were doing all summer long was flying around fishing, which of course the people in the councils did. The fishing was fishing in lakes that had never been fished before was usually remarkable.
Wow.
Yeah. But yeah. In other words, nobody had a clue about the Soviet flights on towards the Soviet ice islands. Nobody had a clue about that, and it didn't come out until, we'll say, Sean Mahoney came out with that story about the spies who went out in the cold.
Wow, that's a Maclean's magazine.
Right. Actually, I wrote another article for the Aircrew magazine. My heading was the Cold War, describing everything which we've covered today, with all of the flights, our various Apex rockets.
Well, that's a good lead into my next question. I'm curious what your thoughts are about the history of what 408 did, and how well has history portrayed it, or poorly.
It was not portrayed. Virtually was not portrayed at all. The only people who really thought about it was the guys who had been there. Yeah. Now, Sean Mahoney did I think bring a lot of it to light, and I think he's worked quite hard doing research on it. As I said, I think he was a little bit off in some things. For instance, the location of those ice islands, as I said earlier, that flight we had, we'll say at least 5 hours each, flying directly each way, which would be pretty close to 1,000 miles.
Wow.
So that was, in other words, that would be 1,000 miles north of Thule, which would be getting up there, probably over the pole.
Right.
And over into the east side, we flew sort of in a northeasterly direction.
Right.
So it would be up over there somewhere.
So if we were writing a history of at least the mapping phase, because I think the reconnaissance phase stands for itself, would you consider that very much a part of the Cold War?
Yes, definitely, because we realized that the airborne area of concern was the high Arctic, because bombers from both sides would have been flying over the poles.
Right.
And so it was very important. That's why the Americans spent probably hundreds of millions of dollars building the Dew Line.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite a big operation.
And the maps that you would have been making would have contributed to the Dew Line sites
Well, very, very, very much, yeah.
Right. What about looking back on the time, either with 408 or any other time, what's one of the fondest memories you have, or the most proudest memory you have of the work you did?
I think the fondest and proudest memories was probably the flying we did. The crew, you know, we were all young guys. I think we got very good at it. I think we were we had some very exciting times, never a dull moment flying in the Arctic, because you never knew what was going to happen next. But I think it did develop quite a cohesive feeling, a lot of very cohesive spirit among us. I know when back in the barracks back in Ottawa, we were very, very close friends. We shared our stories about our goings on when we're not flying and things like that. And we lived very, just like a bunch of good friends. So there was certainly a very strong spirit. Our parties were rather rambunctious, and the rest of the officers in Rockcliffe were all supply people, mm-hmm. Yeah, because it was the Air Materiel Command headquarters, the headquarters of the whole supply section. So they were definitely not air crew. They were supply officers, and they had certainly a different feeling than we had. In fact, I recall coming back from the detachment in Whitehorse to find out that the mess committee had set up bingos every Saturday night in the mess, and we wanted to have dances, of course. So,
wow.
So we had a bit of a, in fact, we attended in full at a mess meeting in full strength and voted the mess committee down, and changed this Saturday night entertainment into dances, because one thing the Ottawa scene at that time was there was many, and there probably still is, many, many single women around the town. We used to go to a place called an afternoon tea dance in downtown in Ottawa, run by the Protestant Girls Club. It was chaperoned by a bunch of matrons who organized this so these young ladies could find suitable brackets Protestant young men. So we would go attend the tea dance and then pick out pick some nice willing people, women, young women, and take them out to the mess to a good rousing dance we'd have in the mess. Now, some of our French-Canadian friends, of course, were not Protestants, so it wouldn't do for them to have a French-Canadian name. So Jean Boulay was called John Brown. But anyway, it was all very above board. But I guess that's an example of how cohesive we were. It was us against everyone else, in a way.
If I can ask you just a bit of an aside, in Rockcliffe, had you ever moseyed over to the number one photographic establishment?
Where they yes, definitely.
Can you tell me anything about that?
that was quite an operation. They, in fact, we visited and they told us how they interpreted some of the photography we'd taken, and by using their 3D imaging, they could establish a three-dimensional view of a flat photography. The way we would do it would be by taking, we had an angle firing camera on the Lancaster, and by taking a direct picture above and then taking one at an angle, by projecting them both together, you'd get a 3D image.
Wow.
which was really gave them a much better picture of what they're actually looking at.
And they would then turn those images over. Did they make maps at number one, or they turned that to, do you remember?
No, the maps were made by the Geodetic Services, which was, I'm not sure what, it was part of another department, but
right,
in fact, the head of the Geodetic Services, I recall, in we met him. He came up to Whitehorse, and his field man, his name was Angus somebody, said that, came up to me and said, the so-and-so, Dr. So-and-so, likes playing billiards. Is there someone here who can play billiards with him? Now, as I graduate, I'm majored in pool in high school in Saskatchewan, a small town in Saskatchewan. So I played billiards with him, and we had a great time. But yeah, he was the head of the whole geodetic survey. I forget his name, but he was a fine old gentleman. Yeah, that was their bailiwick, definitely, and they told us exactly what we had to do to give them the best results from our shore end flights. They,
right.
They wanted, I guess he was aiming for extreme accuracy in his mapping, and I think they got it.
Well, can you tell me about, this is interesting, looking back on it, I sometimes have trouble untangling the civilian role in the mapping effort from the military. I know the RCF obviously flew okay. the Shoran, but
it was a civilian operation. The RCF were tasked; we're the only people who could do it.
Mm-hmm.
So they told us what they wanted. We, in fact, they wanted. They realized that they had to survey all of the Arctic. They had they used ground parties, the feeling was it would have taken them about 200 years. So I suppose in the mid-40s, or we'll say the late 40s, shortly after World War II, they had the problem, how are we going to do this? You know, the government said this must be done. How are we going to do it? Then they came up with this idea of using a radar system, and they did trials in the probably 46, 47, and found it that yes, darn it all, it works like a charm. So away they went. But it was definitely directed by the mapping people. And we worked very closely with them. You know, we had a good cooperative spirit. You know, we realized what they were after, and we had to do our best to get it done. And that's that was our job. You know, and in the end we felt proud of the fact we'd come back. In fact, I wrote in my logbook things like, you know, with the flight 16 transits completed, you know, which was a good deal. That would be doing two lines between two pairs of stations, because you'd do about eight transits, and if everything went well, you know, if you felt that you had received the proper signals, then you felt that you had completed a transit, and to get the best results, you'd get eight transits done with one line, and then you'd go on to the next pair of stations of flying half an hour or an hour further on, and then repeat the whole exercise. So the geodetic people, it was their game. They wanted this done, and they told us what they needed, and then we did it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm coming to the end of my questions. I know we've certainly helped and filled out every single one of them. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to the record? Is there anything I've missed?
I don't think so. Now, I'll give you... Here's an article that Noel Funge, which we've mentioned, Noel and I wrote for RUSI.
Right. I had a quick read at this.
That covers a lot of those flyings. Here's an article that another 408 navigator after my time wrote in reply to to Sean, to Sean Connolly's spies who came, went out into the cold. Mm-hmm. There again, his name is Larry Henry. He also says that the location of those ice islands was further away than was reported.
Right. That's fantastic. Okay. Well, and I can borrow these printouts.
They're yours to keep.
I appreciate that, sir. I appreciate that. Yeah. Well, if you're satisfied.
Yeah. Oh, I think I've told you everything that I can think of. It's 55 years since those days. So.
Well, if anything else comes up, you know, feel free to email me and I'll go home and
get that. I could do that, yeah.
Just to sort of do a bit of the housework here, we now have the interview release form. Yeah. So this is just, I'm sure, as I email it to you, you're okay for us to add this interview to to the library. I can send you a digital copy of the interview, and you can have a listen to it before we do that.
Okay, sure.
But I do need your signature on that. And everything that we send over after, you know, file like the paper and all the documents that we do turn into the library, I'll make sure that you have a look at before we do that and get your green light.
This is the 23rd, isn't it?
You know, I'm quite mixed up on my dates. I think I said the 22nd, but I believe you're right. It is the 23rd.
And if I have just confirm that.
Sure.
Friday the 23rd,
yeah. It is.
Yeah. Be my birthday in another week.
Really?
Yeah.
Happy birthday.
Be 81.
Fantastic.
I'm just leaving to buy out in the following days.
That's absolutely fine. So while we... If you had any advice for a young officer who's heading into the military himself, what would your advice be for a young guy like me about to begin my career in the CF?
Definitely aircrew.
Yeah.
Have you been selected for aircrew?
I have. I've done all of the prior training for pilot.
Oh, you have. Very good.
I'll be heading out to Portage in August this year to go begin flight training.
It's a different service now than it was back then, but it's still, you'll find it will be still a great place. Our superiors were wartime aircrew.
Right.
The bomber command guys lived day by day. Their casualty rates were so high. They became pretty heavy drinkers, mm-hmm. naturally, and they stayed. The ones who stayed in the Air Force after the war, they were our superiors. They were real party types, and there was a lot of drinking went on in the RCF. Mind you, it didn't interfere with our flying. We had very strict rules about that.
Mm-hmm.
No flying, no drinking within 8 hours of flying and things like that. We were very strict about that. But when we finished a flight or when we're sitting around on base, it was a lot of partying. Now, that doesn't happen much anymore. George Baker and I quite often will have lunch in the wardroom,
mm-hmm.
and watching the young officers today, they're a different cut from us. It's not to say that they're as good or anything. They're probably, in fact, probably even better, tending to be a little better educated, perhaps. However, back in those days, high school was equivalent to a university degree anyway, and mm-hmm. really the matriculation was probably, in a lot of cases, a little higher than required for high school now.
Yeah.
But... Yeah, you'll find that you'll have a great career. Now, you'll have a choice of going either on jets, maybe that's the most glamorous, but think about the heavy aircraft, because you'll get around, you'll see the world that way. And even on the Aurora or whatever they replace it with, when I was flying on, after later in my career, I was flying on Arguses, and we got all over the North Atlantic. We'd recover in Iceland, in Norway, England, what have you, Azores. Quite often go down to the Caribbean for winter exercises, so we'd be down flying out of Puerto Rico or for a week or so. We'd always recover on one of the West Indian islands, for instance Barbados, which was a favorite place we'd like to go for a weekend anyway, on our way home type of thing, just a slow show of the flag, you know.
Yeah.
So in other words, what I'm saying is maybe a jet pilot is a little more glamorous, but you fly out of one base and come back to that same base day after day.
Mm-hmm.
You may have practiced dog fights and things like that. And of course, the jet fighter today is almost like playing a computer game. I know one of the old fighter pilots that I know, actually he died about a year ago, but he said he had been flying on the F-86 and the 104, but he said he was taken up on a flight with a CF-18, and he said it was beyond him. He said it's a different game completely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway.
No, I appreciate it. For someone with a career like yourself,
yeah,
it's always good to hear. So I'm just going to, first off, I'll thank you again for letting me come in and for our discussion. Oh. And just to finalize,
as my wife says, you've got someone to listen to your horror stories. I don't anymore.
I'm glad that we can get it on tape and we can let generations.
Yeah. I'm sorry if I tend to ramble a bit, though.
No, but you know, sir, you've covered all of my questions, plus some, without a doubt. So I can't tell you how grateful I am, and they're fascinating stories.
I think you can probably come up with a pretty good story here. Yeah.
No, I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to sit down
and read Mahoney's article, because that gives an insight into the political thinking of that time, which I think is important. It was a different era, you know. After Gazinko, Canada realized that you know things were getting pretty serious.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, I came in during the Korean War. I didn't get to Korea, but I was in the Air Force through the Korean War. And you know, things were not very friendly. In fact, we were flying those Apex rockets. We were a little bit concerned. Are they going to shoot at us? You know, you never know, because as you'll read in Mahoney's article, he gives the number of reconnaissance aircraft that were shot down, which were dozens of them. You know, they'd shot down dozens of them from mainly Americans and British and Swedes, Norwegians, what have you.
Yeah.
Because they didn't like anyone interfering with them. One time when I was flying on an Argus, they had a big, this was in the late 60s, they had a big naval exercise off the Barents Sea, and we flew over with an Argus to photograph them. And by picking up, we had EW equipment on the Argus,
mm-hmm.
and we could tell with all of their their radars, their gun laying radars logged on to us, that they were not too happy. They were ready to press the button.
Wow.
They didn't like being spied on.
Yeah, I could imagine.
So, anyway.
No, this is fantastic, sir. So, the last thing I'll just ask you before I shut down everything here is just, again, in our narratives, that indeed we have both signed the interview release form.
Yes. Excellent. We have, yes.
Okay.
For sure.